Surely it goes without saying, but America, I think you'd agree, is experiencing a golden age in terms of civil discourse and social unity. It's a place where people really, really trust each other, right?
No, I don't think most people can be trusted because I think everybody's always looking for an angle.
Generally speaking, I don't think most people can be trusted.
Society seems to have been changing and separating, and many, many people more than before, I think, are out just for themselves.
Oh, apparently I was wrong. Apparently we don't trust one another so much. Sorry. My mistake. I guess I was thinking of Australia.
Australia is the one which looks like it's bucking the trend and moving towards higher social trust in the last 20, 30 years.
Or maybe I was thinking of the Netherlands.
They're now close to 70% in levels of those who think others can be trusted.
In America, meanwhile, if we're being honest, we're not much on trust these days. Just think of the 2016 election and its aftermath. We mistrusted the candidates and their parties. We mistrusted the police and the FBI. We mistrusted the polls, and some people mistrusted the election result. But wait, maybe there's a bright side. Maybe it's healthy for society to be untrusting, to be skeptical. Maybe it keeps us on our toes, always looking for ways to improve. What's that? Oh, I'm wrong about that too, Professor?
We would be much better off if we were living in a more trustworthy society. Trustworthiness, in short, is a really big deal.
All right, then. Today on Freakonomics Radio, a simple mission to determine why social trust is such a big deal and how to get more of it. Wouldn't you like to know how to do that?
I think that might be a trick question.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Social trust is what exactly?
It's just one of those things. It's sort of like the dark matter of the economy and society matters very greatly, and yet we don't seem to focus on it very much.
That is one of my favorite academic/policy wonks in the world, David Halpern.
I'm the head of the UK's Behavioural Insight Team, often known as the Nudge Unit.
The Nudge Unit applies the findings of behavioural science to do things like increase tax payments, decrease medical errors, and conserve energy. It also looks into broader ideas like social trust. As Halpern was saying,
social trust is an extraordinarily interesting variable and doesn't get anywhere near the attention it deserves. But the basic idea is trying to understand what is it, the kind of the fabric of society that makes economies and indeed just people get along in general. It's clearly so critical for a whole range of outcomes.
Outcomes like economic growth.
This is a more powerful predictor of future national growth rates than, for example, levels of human capital or skills in the population.
Outcomes like individual health.
Basically, having someone or feeling that other people can be trusted or people you can rely on in your life is worth a great deal. It's roughly the same positive effect as giving up smoking. You know, and smoking is really, really bad for you. So, you know, social isolation essentially is incredibly bad for your health.
So can people like Halpern reliably measure the level of social trust in a given place?
Yes, you can do it in a number of ways. You can ask people how many names have they got in their file faxes or in their phones, which will give you some sense of their social networks. You can also measure more subtly with asking a question around social trust. Do you think other people can be trusted, essentially? That's the question we've been asking, in fact, for decades.
And?
There's very big national differences in this. Countries range from, you know, many countries like Brazil, where less than 10% of people would say most others can be trusted, to countries like Norway, where more than 70% of people would say most others can be trusted. Countries like the US and the UK are sort of halfway in between, typically in the range 30 to 40% of people say others can be trusted.
Places with a lot of social trust also have a lot of what's known as social capital. So most people are familiar with physical capital and financial capital, of course. Can you compare social capital to those in any meaningful way?
The answer is, yeah, in fact, you can have a go at doing it. So you can literally work out how much more do people tend to earn if they have more names in their networks, you know, they know more people, or they trust more people in general. You can ask it both at the individual level, and you can also ask it, really importantly, at the community or even national level. So to what extent is it an advantage in terms of your economic growth or your health outcomes to live in a country or a place where people say most others can be trusted? And the answer is, it turns out, some really quite large numbers indeed.
If social trust and social capital are so important, why don't we talk about it all the time, or at least during political campaigns?
So it's an issue which got long roots, but it doesn't mean that governments had done very much about it until very recently. I should explain, I myself wrote a book a number of years ago on social capital, specifically working with, at the time, with Bob Putnam at Harvard.
My name is Bob Putnam. I teach public policy at Harvard University.
Putnam is also the author of the landmark book, Bowling Alone, which was published in 2000. But he started thinking about social capital decades earlier. It began with a question about Italian politics.
Some parts of Italy are way more efficient than any state in America, and other parts of Italy are way more corrupt than any place in America. And the question is, why? Why are some places better governed than others?
The answer, Putnam concluded, didn't have to do with economic development or education level or politics.
It was the degree to which there was a dense civic network in a community. If there was a dense civic network, so that people in those places behaved with respect to one another in a trustworthy way, their governments worked better. And I dubbed that concept social capital.
Meaning?
The core idea of social capital is so simple that I'm almost embarrassed to say it. It is that social networks have value. Social networks have value, first of all, to the people who are in the networks. For example, there's a huge amount of work on how social networks help us find jobs.
Social networks also exert other more indirect leverage.
They have effects on bystanders and not just effects on the people in them. Communities that have high levels of social capital benefit in many ways. Their kids do better in school. They have lower crime rates. They have other things being equal, higher economic growth rates. Many, many benefits, both personally and collectively.
Having made these observations about the power of social capital in Italy, Putnam returned to the U.S.
And I was worried, just as a citizen, not as a scholar, I was worried that ever since I personally began to vote, which was way back in the 1960s, America seemed to be going to hell in a handbasket. And I said to myself, I wonder whether social capital might have something to do with this collapse of American civilization.
So he began looking for measures of connectivity in American civic life. Membership in parent-teacher organizations, for instance.
That is, what fraction of all parents in any given year belong to the PTA? And I discovered, to my shock, that actually PTA membership had been declining a lot.
He looked at membership numbers among Rotary clubs, among scout troops, among bowling leagues. Participation was falling in all these groups.
We were becoming more and more isolated. Or, as a friend suggested to me once, you mean we're bowling alone?
That's a really enormous effect.
David Halpern again, from the British government's Behavioral Insights team. As obvious as the benefits of social capital might seem,
we almost hardly seem to notice that it's there. So it's incredibly consequential, and we see it in lots of areas of policy that we touch on.
So you write this about low trust. Low trust implies a society where you have to keep an eye over your shoulder, where deals need lawyers instead of handshakes, where you don't see the point of paying your tax or recycling your rubbish since you doubt your neighbor will do so, and where you employ your cousin or your brother-in-law to work for you rather than a stranger who would probably be much better at the job. So that has all kinds of business and ultimately economic implications. However, when you talk about high trust being good for us on a personal level, whether it's health or individual income, do the two necessarily go in hand? In other words, can we have a society that has a business climate where there isn't a lot of trust, and therefore you do need all those lawyers instead of the handshakes, but where you have good social trust among neighbors, family and friends, communities, and so on? Or are they really the same thing that you're talking about?
Well, there is a key distinction, and Bob Putnam has often made this too, between what's sometimes called bonding social capital and bridging social capital.
Social capital is about social networks, but not all social networks are identical. And one important distinction is between ties that link us to other people like us That's called bonding social capital.
Bonding social capital often refers to your closeness to your friends, your relatives, those immediately around you. It's particularly important, it turns out, for things such as health outcomes.
Because empirically, if you get sick, the people who are likely to bring you chicken soup are likely to represent your bonding social capital.
So bonding social capital is plainly important, but it's primarily about our ties to people we're close with. When it comes to how our broader society gets along, that's where bridging social capital comes in.
Do you trust not just your immediate neighbor, but those people in your community more generally, or indeed even relative strangers who you meet in everyday life in your country or your society?
So my ties, my friendships to people of a different religion or a different race or a different economic class or a different occupation or different age, that's bridging social capital.
That tends to be really important.
Especially in a modern, diverse democracy like ours. And therefore, what worries me most about trends in America is the decline in bridging social capital.
It's something we saw plenty of during the presidential election. So much distrust among so many separate constituencies, a constant splintering and re-splintering instead of the drawing together that America likes to be known for. So coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we look at an experiment designed to measure trust along racial and ethnic lines. The news is not good.
A lot of the cheating was across racial and ethnic lines.
But there is some good news. For instance,
people who go to university end up trusting much more than those who don't.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So, what have we learned thus far? We've learned that social trust seems to be quite powerful and desirable, but how do you get more of it? You can't just magically turn up social trust in a given place. You can't force everyone to join the PTA or the church group or whatever. So rather than solving for X, where X is how to increase social trust, let's first solve for Y, where Y is when social trust and social capital are low, why are they low?
The short version is that in the short run, increases in diversity seem to be correlated with decreases in social capital.
That's Bob Putnam again. He and others have observed over and over that diversity, racial, ethnic, religious, and so on, make trust more elusive. Consider some research done by the Harvard economist Ed Glaser.
Trust is everywhere in economic transactions. So we wanted to contribute to this literature. And one of the things that seemed very important to us was measuring trust, was measuring social capital.
Rather than relying solely on survey data, Glaser and his colleagues set up an experiment. Not that experiments are perfect either.
So we took a bunch of Harvard undergraduates, because what could possibly be more representative than that?
They tried to measure trust in a variety of ways, including a game where students were paired with each other, with one sending money to the other without being sure whether they'd get the money back.
It's basically meant to mimic the idea of an investor giving money to a firm, and the firm then chooses whether or not to cheat the investor or not.
Some students treated their partners fairly. Others, however, essentially cheated, keeping most or all the money for themselves. When did that happen? It happened when the two players didn't look alike.
A lot of the cheating was across racial and ethnic lines. And this was primarily white on Asian, meaning the whites were cheating the Asians. And I think there are lots of cases in the world in which we've seen racial fractionalization be related to less than perfectly functioning social relations.
Do you think that more ethnically homogenous societies, you know, one argument behind Scandinavian economic and social successes is that they tend to produce better social outcomes? And do you think there's evidence for that?
I do. It is true, for example, that the welfare states are both more generous in ethnically homogeneous places, and it's almost assuredly true that they're also more functional. They function better in more ethnically homogeneous places. It's just easier in lots of ways. There are downsides to that. I mean, I happen to love Stockholm. It's a great city, but certainly one can argue that small homogeneous places are not necessarily as creative as they might be.
So I think there are lots of benefits for being in an ethnically and culturally mixed society.
David Halpern again.
Look, I'm speaking to you today from London, one of the most diverse cities in the world, and it has a deep vibrancy that follows from that. I mean, the real challenge for us is, can we have our cake and eat it? What is it that drives and enables diverse and interesting sort of varied populations, cities, countries, to be able to live together well? That's the real challenge.
Every place in the world, including us, and Canada, are all going to be more ethnically diverse 25 years from now.
And that's Bob Putnam.
Diversity in the long run is a big advantage.
But, he warns,
it's not easy to do diversity. Diversity brings out the turtle in us, that in a more diverse setting, everybody kind of pulls in and disconnects from their neighbors.
But look, if the world is becoming more diverse, and if diversity tends to lower social trust, and if social trust is so important, shouldn't we be looking at ways to handle this problem?
I think so. Although, let's face it, there isn't that much work really doing intervention studies to figure it out.
What strategies I would want to emphasize for moving in a positive direction would be more contexts in which people connect with one another across lines of race or economics or gender or age.
Some classic examples of that? Sports teams, the military, and university. It's also helpful, David Halpern says, simply to look at the countries where social trust has been rising and see what they're up to. The Netherlands, for instance.
In the most recent data, it looks like it's one of the biggest rises. So the Netherlands had pretty similar levels of social trust in the 1980s to America and the UK. But whereas we've now drifted down towards sort of 30-odd percent, they're now up close to 70% in levels of those who think others can be trusted.
What would you say it's caused by?
Well, I mean, one of the characteristics of the Netherlands, and it's, you know, you have to be a bit careful when you pick off one country, is it has wrestled quite hard with the issues of not just inequality, but social differences. They've really tried to do a lot in relation to making people essentially build cohesion. Particularly Amsterdam is a very famous area for it. It's long been an extremely multicultural city. It's had issues over that over time, but they've really, in a sort of succession of governments, have tried to quite actively make groups get along with each other in quite an active way. So that may, of course, itself root in the Netherlands has quite a deep culture of a strong sense of the law being trustworthy and that contracts will be honoured and so on. It's what helped to power its economic success in previous centuries. So it does have that tradition also to draw on.
And what role does technology play in social capital, especially the bridging social capital that people like Halpern and Putnam say is so important? In his book Bowling Alone, Putnam found that social capital was relatively low in the U.S. in the early 1900s and rose fairly steadily through the 1960s. But that's when the decline began.
I looked hard to find explanations, and television, I argued, is really bad for social connectivity for many reasons.
More television watching, Putnam wrote, means less of virtually every form of civic participation and social involvement.
As Bob sometimes put it, I think rather elegantly, when we were looking forward in terms of technology or the internet and, of course, even pre-Facebook and so on, would it be, in his words, a fancy television? In other words, it will isolate us more and more. Or would it be a fancy telephone and would connect us more and more? Because technology has both those capabilities. So when I played video games when I was a kid, you basically did them mostly by yourself or with a friend. When I look at my teenage kids playing videos, they're actually talking to each other all the time. To some extent, it looks like, to me, that we get the technology that we want, and even this is true at a sort of societal level. So one of the arguments you can make, and in my view is true anyway, about explaining some of these differences in the trajectories across countries is, in Anglo-Saxon countries, we've often used our wealth to buy technology and other experiences. To some extent, that's us using our wealth to escape from having to negotiate with other people. But that isn't necessarily the case. Some people and some countries seem to use their wealth more to find ways of connecting more with other people. And the technology has both these capabilities, and we can't just blame it. It's the choices we're making and how we use it and the technology which we're kind of asking and bringing forth.
And when we went out to the streets of New York and asked people the standard survey question, generally speaking, would you say most people can be trusted? We got plenty of affirmatives.
I think so, generally. There's more good people in the world than there are bad people, so that leads me to believe that you can trust people.
Yeah, I would say they could. I think that's maybe like a naive assumption on my part, like to believe that there's good in everyone.
I've had great experiences with strangers. I think in the majority of cases, people are good. I trust people, yeah.
The United States, for all the factionalism and bitterness we've seen in our politics in recent years, is actually well positioned to regenerate social trust, even as the country becomes more diverse. Why? Because, as Bob Putnam argues, we've done it before. A lot.
If we were talking in America in the 1920s or 1930s, the difference between Irish people and Italian people would have been enormous. I have some friends who got married in the 1960s. He was from an Italian background, she was from an Irish background, and when they got married, everybody called it a mixed marriage. Parents on both sides all said mixed marriages never work. And now that seems like a joke, because what's happened in the ensuing years is that the sharp line between Italians and Irish has just disappeared in America. It's not that they don't know that they're from Irish or Italian backgrounds, but it no longer has that same salience. We've done this repeatedly over our own history. This current wave of immigration is not the first time that we have had a big wave of immigration that causes turbulence, and then when you come out the other side, we're all better off. I mean, look, it happens that my ancestors came to this country in 1640, so we've been here forever. And we were doing just fine, and then the Dutch arrived. Now, don't get me started on the Dutch. It was really hard for us to get along with the Dutch, but then eventually we got along with the Dutch, and then we forgot they were Dutch. And then there was just us. And then the Germans arrived, and they were really difficult. We had a lot of trouble assimilating the Germans. And then after a while, we got adjusted to them, and we sort of didn't even notice that the Germans were Germans. And then we invented at that point a term called Anglo-Saxon to refer to the Dutch and the Germans and us. And then we had a lot of trouble when the Irish arrived. I hope you see that there's a smile on my face. We've done this a lot.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, have you ever heard of the gambler's fallacy?
So the gambler's fallacy is expecting that if you've had a streak of a couple of outcomes in a row, that the next outcome is just much more likely to go the other way. And that's just simply not true.
Well, it turns out that gamblers aren't the only people who get fooled by the gambler's fallacy.
We look at Major League Baseball umpires, we look at loan officers, and we even look at federal court asylum judges.
And what do the umpires think of this?
One of the biggest things you have to do when you're an umpire is be honest with yourself.
Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio. And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at freakonomics.com, where you can also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Let's say I flip a coin and it comes up heads. Now I flip it again. Heads again. One more time. And wow, it's three heads in a row. Okay, if I were to flip the coin one more time, what are you predicting? Here's what a lot of people would predict. Let's see, heads, heads, heads. It's got to come up tails this time. Even though you know a coin toss is a random event, that each flip is independent, and therefore the odds for any one coin toss are 50-50. But that doesn't sit well with people.
Toby Moskowitz is an economist at Yale.
We like to tell stories and find patterns that aren't really there. And if you flip a coin, say, 10 times, most people think, and they're correct, that on average you should get 5 heads, 5 tails. The problem is they think that should happen in any 10 coin flips. And of course, it's very probable that you might get 8 heads and 2 tails, or even it's even possible to get 10 heads in a row. But people have this notion that randomness is alternating, and that's not true.
This notion has come to be known as the gambler's fallacy.
This is a common misconception in Vegas. You go to the slot machine, it hasn't paid out in a long time, and people think, well, it's due to be paid out. That's just simply not true if it's a truly independent event, which it is, the way it's programmed.
So, Toby, you have co-authored a new working paper called Decision-Making Under the Gambler's Fallacy. And if I understand correctly, the big question you're trying to answer is how the sequencing of decision-making affects the decisions we make. Is that about right?
That's correct. In fact, the genesis of the paper was really to take this idea of gambler's fallacy, which has been repeated many times in psychological experiments, which is typically a bunch of undergrads playing for a free pizza, and apply it to real-world stakes where the stakes are big, there's a great deal of uncertainty, and these decisions matter a lot.
Some of these decisions matter so much, they can mean the difference between life and death. So these probably aren't the kind of decisions we should be making based on this. So Toby Moskowitz and his co-authors, Daniel Chen and Kelly Hsu, have written this interesting research paper. It's the kind of paper that academics publish by the thousand. They publish in order to get their research out there, maybe to get tenure, etc. So it matters for them. Does it matter for you? Why should you care about something like the gambler's fallacy? Well, we often talk on this program about the growing science of decision-making. But it's funny. Most of the conversations focus on the outcome for the decision-maker. What about the people the decision is affecting? What if you are a political refugee hoping to gain asylum in the United States? There's a judge making that decision. What if you're trying to get your family out of poverty in India by starting a business and you need a bank loan? There's a loan officer making that decision. Or what if you're a baseball player waiting on a 3-2 pitch that's going to come at you 98 miles an hour from just 60 feet 6 inches away? That's where the umpire comes in.
We'll start with Major League Baseball. That was a simple one.
Moskowitz and his co-authors analyzed decision-making within 3 different professions: baseball umpires, loan officers, and asylum judges, to see whether they fall prey to the gambler's fallacy. Because
there's all kinds of possible areas where the sequence of events shouldn't matter, but our brains think they should, and that causes us to make poor decisions.
Decisions that are the result of
what I would call decision heuristics.
A heuristic being essentially a cognitive shortcut. Now, why choose baseball umpires?
Because baseball has this tremendous data set called PitchFX, which records every pitch from every ball game. And what it records is, if you look at the home plate umpire, where the pitch landed, where it was located within or outside the strike zone, and also what the call was from the umpire.
Moskowitz and his colleagues looked at data from over 12,000 baseball games, which included roughly 1.5 million called pitches. That is, the pitches where the batter doesn't swing, leaving the umpire to decide whether the pitch is a ball or a strike. As they write in the paper, "We test whether baseball umpires are more likely to call the current pitch a ball after calling the previous pitch a strike, and vice versa." There were 127 different umpires in the data. The researchers did not focus on pitches that were obvious balls or strikes.
If you take a pitch dead center of the strike zone, umpires get that right 99% of the time.
Instead, they focused on the real judgment calls.
So the thought experiment was as follows. Take 2 pitches that land in exactly the same spot. The umpire should be consistent and call that pitch the same way every time, because the rules state that each pitch is independent in terms of calling it correctly. It's either in the strike zone or it's not.
The first thing the PitchFX data shows is that umpires are generally quite fallible.
On pitches that are just outside the strike zone, they're definitely balls, but they're close. On those pitches, umpires only get those right about 64% of the time. So that's a 36% error rate. It's big.
Slightly better than flipping a coin, but not much.
Not much, yeah. Better than you and I could do, though, I would say.
And how does the previous pitch influence the current pitch?
Just as a simple example, if the previous pitch was a strike, the umpire was already about 0.5% less likely to call the next pitch a strike.
0.5% doesn't seem like that big an error, but keep in mind that's for the entire universe of next pitches, whether it's right down the middle or high and outside or in the dirt. What happens when the next pitch is a borderline call?
So if you look at pitches on the corners, near the corners, that's where you get a much bigger effect. So as an example, if I see two pitches on the corners, one that happened to be preceded by a strike call and one that didn't, the one preceded by a strike call, the next pitch will less likely be called a strike about 3.5% of the time. Now, if I increase that further, if the last two pitches were called a strike, then that same pitch will less likely be called a strike 5.5%. So those are pretty big numbers.
And let me just ask you, other than finishing location of the pitch, what other factors relating to pitch speed or spin or angle, et cetera, did you look at and or could you control for? And is that important?
You always want to control for those things because some people might argue, well, maybe they see it differently if it's a 98-mile-an-hour fastball versus a 80-mile-an-hour slider or curve. Maybe that changes the optics for the umpire. So we try to control for all that. And the beautiful thing about baseball is they have an enormous amount of data. We threw in things like the horizontal spin and vertical distance of the pitch, the movement of it, the speed, the arc when it leaves the pitcher's arm to when it crosses the plate. We also control for who the pitcher was, who the batter was, and even who the umpire was.
Since you're controlling for the individual umpires, I assume you have a list of the best and worst umpires, yes?
On this dimension, yes. And it turns out they're all pretty much about the same. So you could either view them as equally good or equally bad. There wasn't a single umpire that didn't exhibit this kind of behavior. They all fell prey to what we interpret as the gambler's fallacy in terms of calling pitches, which stands to reason because they're all human.
One of the biggest things you have to do when you're an umpire is be honest with yourself.
That's Hunter Wendelstedt.
Well, now I'm a Major League Baseball umpire. I have been in the major leagues full time since 1999. So I've been able to travel this great country doing something I love, and that's umpiring baseball games.
Wendelstedt's father, Harry, was also a major league umpire, an extremely well-regarded one. Harry also ran the Wendelstedt Umpire School near Daytona Beach, Florida, which Hunter now runs during the offseason. They start with the fundamentals.
You hold up a baseball. Here's a baseball. Here are the measurements of the baseball. Here's the weight of the baseball. Same thing with the bat. And you go step by step. There's a proper way for an umpire to put their mask on and take their mask off so as to not block their vision. Different ways to ensure that you get the best look you can. And that's the first 7 to 11 days.
If you're fortunate enough to make it as an umpire all the way to the majors, you know you'll be subject to a great deal of scrutiny.
Because now, on any given day, at every major league stadium, you have cameras, most of them high definition, super slow motion, that are critiquing every pitch and every play.
Wendelstedt is a fan of the pitch FX system that Toby Moskowitz used to analyze umpire decisions.
As once these pitch systems got into place, and it's been a great educational tool for us because you look at it and we get a score sheet after every game we work behind the plate, and it tries to see if you have any trends. And it really helps us become a better quality product for the game of baseball.
We sent Hunter Wendelstedt the Moskowitz research paper, which argues that major league umpires succumb to the gambler's fallacy.
I was reading that. I got nervous. But that was really interesting. You know, that's just stuff I've never even thought about. It's kind of blowing my mind the last couple of days. It's pretty neat.
But Wendelstedt wasn't quite ready to accept the magnitude of umpire error the researchers found.
I think it's very interesting. And I really look forward to studying that some more because, you know, running the umpire school and all that, you got to keep up on the trends and the way that the perception is going out there also.
Wendelstedt did say that if an umpire makes a bad call, whether behind the plate or in the field, you don't want to try to compensate later.
And if you miss something, the worst thing to do, you can never make up a call. People, oh, that's a makeup call. Well, no, it's not, because if you try and make up a call, now you've missed two. And that's something that we would never, ever want to do.
The Moskowitz research paper only analyzed data for the home plate umpire, the one calling balls and strikes. For those of you not familiar with baseball, there are four umpires working every game, one behind home plate and one at each of the three bases. The umps rotate positions from game to game, so a given ump will work the plate only every few games. Interestingly, baseball uses six umps during the postseason, adding two more down the outfield lines, which has always struck me as either a jobs program or a rare admission of umpiring fallibility. Because if you need those two extra umps to get the calls right during the postseason, doesn't that imply they ought to be there for every game? In a more overt admission of the fallibility of umpires, baseball has increasingly been using video replays to look at close calls. In such cases, the calls are overturned nearly half the time. Nearly half the time. Calls by the best umpires in the world. Which might make you question the fundamental decision-making ability of human beings generally, and whether we'd be better off getting robots to make more of the relatively simple judgment calls in our life, like whether a baseball pitch is a ball or a strike. But human nature being what it is, and most of us having an undeservedly high opinion of ourselves as good decision makers, we probably won't be seeing wholesale automation of this kind of decision making anytime soon. Making decisions, after all, is a big part of what makes us human. So it's hardly surprising we'd be reluctant to give that up. But if the gambler's fallacy is as pronounced as Toby Moskowitz and his colleagues argue, you might wish otherwise. Especially if you are, say, applying for a bank loan in India.
And we got a little bit lucky here.
Lucky, meaning some other researchers had already run an experiment
with a bank in India and a bunch of loan officers on actual loans.
And the data from that experiment allowed Moskowitz and his co-authors to look for evidence of the gambler's fallacy. Because
what they did was they took that data and they reassigned them to other loan officers,
which allowed for a randomization of the sequence of loan applications.
Suppose you and I looked at the same six loans. I happened to look at them in descending order. You happen to look at them in ascending order, let's say alphabetically, just some way to rank them. And then the question is, did we come to different decisions just purely based on the sequencing of those loans?
Now, keep in mind, these were real loan applications that an earlier loan officer had already approved or denied. This let the researchers measure an approval or denial in the experiment against the correct answer, although the correct answer in this case isn't nearly as definitive as a correct ball or strike call in baseball. Why? Because if a real loan application had been denied, the bank had no follow-up data to prove whether that loan actually would have failed.
But the loans that were approved, we can look at the performance of that loan later on. You could see whether it was delinquent or didn't pay off as well. So unlike baseball, where we know for sure there's an error, here it's not quite clear.
How much did loan officers in India fall prey to the gambler's fallacy?
So you and I are looking at the same six set of loan applications. And the sequence with which I received them, suppose I had three very positive ones in a row, then I'm much more likely to deny the fourth one, even if it was as good as the other three.
The analysis showed that the loan officers got it wrong roughly 8% of the time simply because of the sequence in which they saw the applications. Talk for just a minute about why this kind of experiment, a field experiment, is inherently, to people like you, more valuable than a lab experiment with a bunch of undergrads trying to get some free pizza, for instance.
Well, that's right. Well, in this particular case, this is their job, first of all. So you're dealing with experts in their own field making decisions that they should be experts on, as opposed to maybe very smart undergrads, but making a decision on something they haven't had a lot of experience doing and shouldn't be considered experts doing. The second thing is incentives.
Incentives. One beauty of the original experiment was that it had the loan officers working under one of three different incentive schemes, which allows you to see if the gambler's fallacy can perhaps be overcome by offering a strong enough reward. Some loan officers operated under a weak incentive scheme,
which basically meant you just got paid for doing your job, whether you got it right or wrong, what we would call flat incentive.
Then there was a moderate incentive scheme,
which is we'll pay you a little more if you get it right, and then pay you a little bit less when you get it wrong.
And finally, some loan officers were given a strong incentive scheme,
which was we'll pay you a little bit more to get it right, but we'll punish you severely for getting it wrong, meaning you approved it when it should have been denied, or you denied it when it should have been approved, then it cost you money.
So how was the gambler's fallacy affected under stronger incentives?
Well, this was the most interesting part.
With the strongest incentive at play, where loan officers were significantly rewarded or punished for not messing up an application simply because of the order they read it,
we found that 8% error rate, or I should say what we ascribe to the gambler's fallacy affecting decision making, goes down to 1%.
Wow.
Doesn't get eliminated completely, but pretty nicely. We then looked at what the loan officers did in order to get that 8% down to 1%. It turns out they ended up spending a lot more time on the loan application. If they make a quick decision, they rely on these simple heuristics of, well, I just approved 3 loans in a row, I should probably deny this one. But if I'm forced to actually just use information and think about it slowly because I really want to get it right, because I get punished if I don't, then I don't rely on those simple heuristics as much. I force myself to gather the information and I make a better decision.
Or to put it in non-academic terminology, if you're paid a lot to not suck at something, you'll tend to not suck.
If effort can help. That's right.
Even if you've never watched a baseball game in your life, even if you don't care at all whether someone in India gets a bank loan, you might care about how the United States runs its immigration courts and whether it decides to grant or deny asylum to a petitioner.
This is clearly a big decision, certainly for the applicants, right? I mean, in some cases, it could mean the difference between life and death, right? Or imprisonment and not imprisonment if they have to go back to their country where they're fleeing for political reasons or something else.
These cases are heard in immigration courts by federal judges. Each case is randomly assigned, which, if you're an applicant, is a hugely influential step. As Toby Moskowitz and his co-authors write, New York at one time had 3 immigration judges who granted asylum in better than 8 of 10 cases, and 2 other judges who approved fewer than 1 in 10. So as the researchers compiled their data to look at whether the gambler's fallacy is a problem in federal asylum cases, they focused on judges with more moderate approval rates. The data went from 1985 to 2013.
So we looked only at judges that decided at least 100 cases in a given court and only looked at courts or districts that had at least 1,000 cases. Among that set across the country over those several decades, you're talking about 150,000 decisions, and I think it was 357 judges making those decisions. So quite a large sample size.
The researchers controlled for a number of factors: the asylum seeker's country of origin, the success rate of the lawyer defending them, even time of day, which, believe it or not, can be really important in court. A 2001 paper looked at parole hearings in Israeli prisons to see how the judges' decisions were affected by extraneous factors. Hunger, perhaps. This study found that judges were much more likely to grant parole early in the day, shortly after breakfast, presumably, and again, shortly after the lunch break. So Moskowitz and his colleagues tried to filter out all extraneous factors in order to zoom in on whether the sequencing of cases affected the judges' rulings. Keep in mind, there's also no way to measure a correct ruling.
When a judge denies a certain case, we don't know for sure if that was the right or the wrong decision. So I want to qualify that, because what we can show is whether the sequencing of approval or denial decisions has any bearing on the likelihood that the next case is approved or denied. And that we show pretty strongly.
So what does it look like for an asylum judge to be affected by the gambler's fallacy?
So if the cases are truly randomly ordered, then what happened to the last case should have no bearing on this case, right? Not over large samples. And what we find is that's not true. If the previous case was approved by the judge, then the next case is less likely to be approved by almost 1%. Where it gets really interesting is if the previous two cases were approved, then that drops even further to about 1.5%. And if these happen on the same day, that goes up even further to closer to 3%. And then obviously if it's, you know, two cases in the same day, it gets even bigger. It starts to approach about 5%. So those are pretty big numbers, especially for the applicants involved. Or to put it a little differently, just by the dumb luck of where you get sequenced that day could affect your probability of staying in this country by 5% versus going back to the country that you're fleeing. That's a remarkable number, in my opinion.
So the lesson, if I'm seeking asylum or any other ruling, what I really want to do is bribe someone to let me get to the judge right after he or she has rejected the previous few applicants, right? I mean, what other than that?
It would be worth it.
Well, plainly, it would be really, really, really worth it unless you get caught bribing and then obviously get rejected for asylum because of just that. So you're telling us the data from the decision maker's side. What about the seeker's side? Is there anything that can be done to offset this bias?
I'm not sure there's much you can do. You're at the mercy of the courts. I suppose if you have a particularly good lawyer, maybe there's a way to lobby. I mean, I'm told the cases are randomized. I assume that's true. But who knows? Like you said, maybe bribes is a bit extreme, but maybe there's a way.
Well, feigning illness, at least, to break the streak, right?
Exactly. I mean, there's all kinds of things that perhaps a good lawyer could do.
The evidence that Moskowitz and his colleagues present is, to me at least, fairly compelling evidence that decision makers in these three realms, courts, banks, and baseball, occasionally make poor decisions based on nothing more substantial than the order they face the decisions. But what if these researchers are just wrong? What if there are other explanations?
No, that's a fair question. There are certainly other possible things to consider, and we try to rule them out. The first thing, the most obvious thing would be that the quality or merits of cases has that similar pattern. That seems hard to believe. We believe, you know, the randomization of cases, certainly in the loan officer experiment where we know it's randomized because we did it and these other economists randomized it themselves, we know we can rule that out. So I don't think that's an issue, but maybe just the quality of cases has this sort of alternating order to it and these guys are actually making the right decision. We don't think that's true. And in baseball, we can actually prove it by showing that they're getting the wrong call.
It's also interesting, to me at least, that what the Moskowitz research is pushing against is an instinct that a lot of people are trying to develop, which is pattern spotting. More and more, especially when we're dealing with lots of data, we look perhaps harder than we should for streaks or anomalies that aren't real. We may look for bias that isn't necessarily bias. Our umpire friend Hunter Wendelstedt brought this up when we asked whether, as most baseball fans believe, umpires treat certain pitchers with undue respect.
Well, you know, here's the thing about it. You take Clayton Kershaw, the umpire is going to call more strikes when Clayton Kershaw's out there. Why? Is it because we like him better? No. It's because he throws more strikes, because he's a better pitcher than a rookie that's getting the call up from the New Orleans Zephyrs. It's one of those things. The reason that Greg Maddux and John Smoltz, they're in the Hall of Fame for a reason.
Toby Moskowitz points to one more barrier to unbiased decision-making, related to the gambler's fallacy but slightly different. It's another bias known as
sequential contrast effects. That sounds like a very technical term, but it's a pretty simple idea. The idea is if I read a great book last week, then the next book I read, even if it's very, very good, I might be a little disappointed because my reference for what a really good book is just went up.
And you could see how that phenomenon would really be important in, let's say, job applicants or any kind of applicant, yeah?
Correct. We see this all the time, that the sequence of candidates that come through for a job, I think, matters, both from the gambler's fallacy as well as from sequential contrast effects.
So I, along with a couple of other researchers, were interested in this idea of sequential decision errors.
That's Kelly Hsu.
I'm an associate professor of finance at University of Chicago, the Booth School of Business.
She's also one of Toby Moskowitz's co-authors on the Gambler's Fallacy paper, and she's a co-author on another paper called A Tough Act to Follow, Contrast Effects in Financial Markets.
And I was talking to some asset managers in New York, and they said that when they consider earnings announcements by firms, their perception of how good the current earnings announcement was is very much skewed by what they've recently seen.
So Xu and her colleagues collected data on firms' quarterly earnings announcements from 1984 to 2013 to see how the markets responded.
We look at how that firm's share price moves on the day of the earnings announcement and in a short time window before and after that announcement.
And what did they find?
So what we find is that if yesterday an unrelated large firm announced a very good earnings announcement, it makes today's earnings announcement seem kind of less good in comparison. And on the other hand, suppose yesterday's earnings announcement was pretty disappointing, then today's news, all else equal, looks more impressive.
Before you go thinking that stock market investors are particularly shallow, Xu notes that contrast effects like these have been widely observed in lab experiments.
So what they've shown is that subjects will judge crimes to be less egregious if they've recently been exposed to narratives of more egregious crimes. College students will rate pictures of their female classmates to be less attractive if they've recently been exposed to videos of more attractive actresses. So something we believe something fairly similar is happening in the context of earnings.
In this research, as well as the gambler's fallacy research, the timing of the consecutive decisions really matters. Toby Moskowitz again.
Meaning, if the decisions that you're making occur very close in time, then you tend to fall prey to the sequencing effect. So take the judge's example, for instance. We find that if cases are approved on the same day, then the likelihood of the next case that same day goes way down. If those cases were one day removed, the effect gets a lot weaker. Or, in fact, if there's a weekend in between the decisions, then it's almost non-existent. So if the judge approved a bunch of cases on Friday, that really doesn't have much bearing on what happens Monday.
Moskowitz has tried to apply this insight to his own decision-making when it comes to grading students' papers.
If I see a sequence of good exams that may affect the poor students who happen to be later in the queue in my pile, but one of the things I try to do, mostly just because I don't want my head to explode, is I take frequent breaks between grading these papers, and I think that breaks that sequencing. My mind sort of forgets about what I did in the past because I've done something else in between.
What do you do during your breaks?
Go for a walk, check email, get some coffee, maybe work on something else. Or, you know, my students don't want to hear this, but occasionally I'll grade an exam in front of a baseball game and, I'll stop and watch a couple of innings.
Obviously, every realm is different. A loan officer is different from a baseball umpire, is different from an asylum judge, is different from a professor grading papers and so on. But what they all would seem to have in common is a standard of, you know, competence or excellence or whatnot. And so is there any way for all of us to try to avoid the bias of the gambler's fallacy, to try to, I guess, connect more with an absolute measure rather than a relative measure?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it does depend on the field. Obviously, if you think about asylum judges, the absolute measure, you know, sort of your overall approval or denial rate might be good from a judge's perspective, but it's certainly not great from the applicant's perspective if you make a lot of errors on the side, right? The errors may balance out, but to those applicants, there's huge consequences.
Moskowitz plays tennis, where there's plenty of opportunity for a rethink on the sequencing of shots.
If you're serving, for instance, one of the best strategies is a randomized strategy, like a pitcher should do in baseball. And I'm not very good at being random, just like most humans. I'll say to myself, well, I hit the last couple down the middle. Maybe I should go out wide on this one. But that's not really random. What I should do is what some of the best pitchers in baseball do. Rumor has it Greg Maddux used to do this, which is recognizing that he's not very good at being random. He would use a cue in the stadium that was totally random. For instance, are we in an even or an odd inning? And is the time on the clock even or odd? some other cue that would just give him a sense of, well, I'll throw a fastball if there's two, you know, if the clock ends on an even number and the inning's even, I'll throw a slider. If it's an odd, I should say to myself, you know, if the score is even or odd, or if whatever, if I count, you know, five blades of grass on the court as opposed to three, something that's totally random that has nothing to do with it allows me to supply that random strategy, which my brain is not very good at doing. Most people's brains aren't.
It's an interesting paradox that it takes a pretty smart person to recognize how not smart we are at doing something as seemingly simple as being random, because it wouldn't seem to be so difficult, right?
I would say that's fairly true in general, that the smartest people I know are so smart because they know all the things they don't know and aren't very good at, and that's a very tough thing to do.
I'm Stephen Dubner. That's our show. Thanks for listening. And remember, wherever you are and whenever you'd like, you can listen to our Freakonomics Radio podcast. You can get it at Freakonomics.com or Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe.